All right. Just to provide some guidance for counsel about the oral argument, we are not interested in hearing oral argument about the issues of infringement or invalidity that in part form the basis for the stay motion. Our focus is only on the stay motion as to commercial operators and gate operators. It's going to be a little bit difficult here because unlike normal arguments, we don't have a joint appendix. And we've had, at least I've had difficulty in accessing some of the ITC record because it's sealed. So we'll work through that as best we can. Okay, so let's start with Ms. Degner.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lauren Degner for the Chamberlain Group.
You can take your mask off if you want.
Thank you, Your Honor. Forgive me. Okay, well, with this guidance, we will start by saying the court, the ITC lacked authority to issue the orders, and they should be stayed until this court rules on our underlying appeal and the case in full. If I could, I would...
Lacks authority to issue the orders? What do you mean?
It lacked authority to enter the modified remedial orders because they were not clarifications of the other orders, but rather they were modified orders under subsection
K. Agencies normally have the ability to reconsider their decisions, and from the record here, one can infer that there was a simple mistake in the way the orders were written, and that that was corrected. Now, whether that was a modification or a clarification is an issue. But surely the ITC has the authority to correct a mistake, and the fact that the statute speaks only in terms of modifications for changed circumstances wouldn't limit them from correcting a mistake, would it?
So, Your Honor, we would disagree with the notion that what happened here was simply correcting a mistake.
But just theoretically.
Theoretically, does it have the opportunity? Now, I would say it does not have the authority to correct a mistake if that mistake, the correction thereof, would actually expand the scope of the orders, which in this case mirrored the scope of the investigation and the notice of investigation.
Okay. But what if there's something in the record that one could discern that makes it painfully obvious that the description of the accused products in the remedial order was mistakenly designated. Would the commission under those circumstances, where it really is painfully obvious, given the course of the investigation and the way the parties litigated the case, that there was just a mistake in what was identified and described as the products to be excluded. Would that be within the ITC's inherent authority to say, oh, I see that there was a mistake. We need to do some kind of errata. Yes, maybe that errata would actually end up expanding the scope of the accused products, but nonetheless, it's a clear and plain error. Would that be okay?
So to answer your question without getting into why I disagree that there was a mistake here, I think what we see in the regulations, the agency still has to follow its regulations, and to correct a mistake in the notice of investigation, there has to be a publication of it. And so here we have to remember that the orders specifically mirror the language in the notice of investigation. I don't think the ITC, even to correct a mistake, could sua sponte after an investigation had been terminated, change the orders and also change the notice of investigation without giving the public notice, given the regulations it has
before.
Why
not? If it were an evident mistake in the language of the notice of investigation as well as in the exclusion order, why can't mistakes be corrected by an agency?
So I think in this case, the agency has a regulation that says how you would make corrections or amendments to the notice of investigation that was not followed. So
But that regulation and statute is for a particular circumstance for why you might make a modification or alteration to an order. What? And that I don't know if that's so confining that it's the only way, and that therefore the commission, you know, unlike, you know, any other tribunal, is without the inherent authority to make a correction to a mistake in any of its orders.
So I think that the regulation we're discussing talks in terms of time post-institution. And so here it would apply because it was post-institution. And so it should be complied with. And, you know, at a very high level, do we disagree with the fundamental presence that there can be some errors that can be corrected? But here, there was not a reconsideration of the past decision. It was, you know, it was changing the scope of a terminated investigation. And it was not reconsidering what had happened.
You agree, don't you, that the ITC has the authority to modify a remedial order when it believes that there's been a change in circumstances?
I agree that Section K allows that if there has in fact been a change in circumstance,
modified. That's not what I'm saying. You do agree that the ITC has authority to modify a remedial order when it believes that there's been a change in circumstances.
Well, I guess I want to make sure I understand the import of it believes there's been a change circumstance.
I'm just trying to understand your argument.
Right, my argument
is... And I'm asking you a question.
Yes. If there has been a change in circumstances and it may institute modification proceedings, I would quibble only with it believes that there has been a change in circumstances saying it believes it so doesn't mean it is.
Okay, so your answer is yes.
Of course, yes. The statute allows it.
Is a motion for clarification by one of the parties to the investigation, can that constitute a change of circumstances?
So I don't think the mere filing of a motion would qualify as change circumstances. The examples that have been done in the past are things like settlement.
A motion for a clarification of a remedial order, does that give the ITC authority to modify one of its orders? Would that constitute a change circumstance?
I would say no. Not the mere filing of a motion does not qualify as change circumstances.
Well, what if the clarification was to say there's a typographical error and these three words were left out of the order and everybody agrees to it, that the three words should have been included in the order? Are you saying that that's not a change of circumstances that allows the ITC to go back and modify or clarify that remedial order?
So in your hypothetical, you're saying all parties agree to a modification? I would say two things. The mere filing of a motion is not, there's no change of circumstance there in terms of the facts of the investigation.
I'm not asking if there's one here. I'm just asking generally. In ITC practice and under the applicable statutes and regulations, I'm trying to explore here the ITC's authority, which you brought up in your argument. Okay.
So I would say in your hypothetical, where all the parties agree to make a change, that can be done by stipulation. I would not characterize that as a change circumstance.
Well, then are you saying that the ITC can never go back and correct something like that?
Under Section K, which requires a change circumstance, I would say no.
Okay, well, let's assume for the moment that we disagree with you, and we conclude that the ITC does have the authority to modify its orders if the language of the order doesn't accomplish what it wants to accomplish. Let's assume that that's correct. Your theory, as I understand it, is that under those circumstances, if there is a modification as opposed to a clarification of the order, there has to be a new 60-day review period, correct?
Our view is if the modification expands the scope of the orders, it's more narrow than just any change at all. If it expands the scope of the orders, it cannot be done under K, it has to be done under B, and under subsection B, it would be a new remedial order, and that would trigger subsection J and presidential review. That is our position.
And how are you injured by the failure of the ITC under those circumstances to provide for a new 60-day presidential review period? Is that simply because you've been deprived of the opportunity to bring product into the United States under the bonding provision for the 60-day period?
It's twofold. But the primary injury is that we are denied the opportunity to bring before USTR relevant information and facts about this expanded scope, the gate operators and the commercial operators. The public has been denied the opportunity. Those products are more often put into fire stations, public, governmental, hospitals, those members of the public are also denied the opportunity. And so we were denied the opportunity to convince USTR to disallow the orders entirely.
Well, what if we were to find that the modification did not expand the scope of the order?
If you were to find that it did not expand the scope of the order, I think there's still an error here. The error is the method, the procedure that was followed, where there was a modification proceedings opened and terminated on the same day with no notice to the public. Your hypothetical, your interpretation, it would obviously take away our argument that Section K does not permit expanding remedial orders.
Okay, but it sounds as though there's been a design around here, and the Customs for the moment has ruled that the design around is non-infringing, correct? So where's the irreparable injury going forward if you're able to bring the design around product into the United States without its being excluded?
So we are certainly, the Customs decision is a welcome one. It mitigates but does not eliminate the irreparable harm. As this court knows, Customs is not the last decision. And the harm, even to the redesigns, comes in the form...
Well, for the moment, I mean, the Customs ruling stands and the redesigned products don't be admitted, right? I mean, there may be a mechanism to overturn that Customs decision, but as long as the Customs decision stands... You can bring the redesigned product into the United States, right?
But these unlawful orders...
Yes?
As long as the Customs decision stands, we can bring the product into the country. Oh, that's correct.
So if during that period in which the Customs decision stands, how is it that you're irreparably injured by the exclusion order applicable to the original product?
These unlawful orders are being used to sow fear, uncertainty, and doubt in the marketplace that causes us irreparable harm. Even yesterday, Overhead Door has told people that the litigation continues and further interruption of importation may occur depending on the International Trade Commission's independent evaluation of the redesigned product.
But that's so
the enforcement
amorphous.
Action
that's
is imminent.
Wait. That's amorphous, and it's assuming a change in the customs regulation. I'd have difficulty in seeing how that's irreparable injury. You have said nothing about, for example, an accumulation of the original product which you're barred from bringing into the United States. Why is there irreparable injury when you're able to bring the redesigned product in and satisfy your customer needs that way?
Well, let me say two things. First, on the redesigned products, the actual supply disruption we already experienced, and the threatened supply disruption via an enforcement action is damaging our brand. It's damaging our customer relationships, our industry goodwill, our credibility with the customers.
Okay,
these are irreparable harms.
Can I then assume that you don't have any original product which is being excluded here?
So the answer is, I was getting to that. We cannot move inventory. We do have inventory that the orders prevent us from moving.
Said anything about that.
No, you're right, Your Honor. That was not in our declaration, but I confirmed it yesterday with the client to answer your question.
So did you take the old product that was found to be infringing and convert it, by doing something to the code so that they now, at least in customs view, are no longer infringing? Or did you build a whole new generation of gate operators and garage door openers that have different operating codes so that under customs view they no longer infringe?
So the way I understand it, Judge Chen, is that we did not take other products and reflash them. That's my understanding. I think if not all, the bulk, the hardware, like we still buy the same hardware components. We built new hardware and then loaded new redesigned software on the products. Does that understand your question? You understand how you could take another product and just reflash
I'm just
it?
Trying to understand.
That's not, I understand
I'm
what
happened. I'm trying to understand. Did you have some inventory of garage door openers and gate operators that were found to be infringing, and so you were blocked from importing them, but then you just went into that warehouse, and with all of those products, you converted them by doing something to turn off some functionality, so that now under customs view, those products, those old products which you converted, ended up being deemed by customs to be no longer infringing?
My understanding is no. We're talking brand new manufactured products that happened to use some of the same hardware, if not all the same hardware, and then software was loaded. We did not take previously, there wasn't a set of inventory outside the United States already existing that was reflashed. You understand? We do have inventory in the United States that have not been reflashed and just sitting there that we cannot move. But outside the United States, there was not a cache of products that only had their software changed. Mm-hmm. Rather, we manufactured new products and loaded new redesigned software on them. That is my understanding. I can certainly, we can make representations to the court if you want, I guess, with more specifics.
But just to put a finer point on it, at this point today, given customs letter, your basis for irreparable harm at this point is based on the view that there's still some specter of being enjoined and blocked from even being able to sell the redesigned product in this country. Is that right?
It is the cloud. Is the cloud, yes. It's the specter, cloud. The cloud, which we say is real, it is tangible, and over at Door is being extremely aggressive with the threats.
What I'm trying to figure out is, why can't this just all be resolved in your normal appeal process in front of a normal merits panel instead of in this unique setting of an emergency motion to stay everything pending the appeal when, as a technical matter, you're able to move inventory right now?
No, I appreciate the question, Judge Chen. What I would say is that the harm to our reputation, our relationship with our customers may never recover by virtue of these unlawful orders that, you know, put a cloud over our products. And even the economic loss that typically the cases say is not irreparable, I mean, that is when it's a recoverable economic loss. We don't have a recoverable economic loss here. And I think even the Wisconsin gas case that they cite, but NTE Connecticut, another DC circuit that says, we have no mechanism to be made whole for all the sales we are losing because of the cloud that these unlawful modified remedial orders put on our products. I see I'm into my red time.
At the end of the day, in one of your replies, it seems to me that Chamberlain acknowledges that if its redesigned products are allowed into the United States, that it will suffer no irreparable harm. So reading that and accepting that at face value, if Customs allows the redesigned products to come in, which apparently it will, I mean, it's are said that it's outside the scope, your redesigned products, then it seems to me that by your own language, you don't suffer irreparable harm. That precludes me as a matter of law from granting the stay.
So I appreciate the sentence you're referring to, and I don't think that sentence says there'll be no harm. Certainly the harm is mitigated.
Here's what it says. So long as Chamberlain is not permitted to import and distribute these redesigned products, it suffers irreparable harm in the form of damaged customer relationships, et cetera, et cetera. So the opposite must be true. If they do allow the redesigned products into the United States, you're not going to suffer irreparable harm in those particular areas. These are your own words.
I know there are words, and they are silent as to the harm that would continue to be suffered by Chamberlain.
Well, it's not when irreparable.
We would say it is irreparable. As I said, we cannot repair the relationship.
Then you're contradicting your own words.
I certainly don't want to tell you how to interpret the... That is not what we meant. I don't think that's what we said.
Okay.
But certainly it's been mitigated. There's no question. The customs decision has mitigated the harm, but it's not eliminated entirely.
Okay, unless there are further questions, why don't we hear from Mr. Rosenzweig? We'll give you 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Would the court like me to start with irreparable harm or with likelihood of success?
Well, let's talk first about the language of the order, which the original exclusion order said covered articles are limited to the following garage door systems and components thereof. And how can it be that that language covers gate operators and commercial operators?
Well, it's in the context of the investigation, Your Honor, and on In the ID, the ID had specific findings on this issue at page 13. So the final ID here was Exhibit 3 to Overhead Doors, opposition to the motion to stay.
Okay, but I
so there's a page that it.
I don't think you're quite answering my question, because we in DeFurco we said you've got to have language in the order which is capable of the desired construction. And here, the order seems to be pretty explicit. It says covered articles are limited to the following: garage door systems and components thereof, so on and so forth. How is it that that language, how is it that that language can cover gate operators and commercial operators? Was that language in the course of the proceeding ever used to describe commercial operators and gate operators?
Yes, I mean, the ALJ found that at the time of the ID, that the scope of the investigation included gate operators and commercial operators, plainly despite the fact that the notice of investigation read as it read. Now, those are findings of fact, and those are conclusions of law. Now, if Chamberlain believes that that analysis is incorrect as a matter of law, it's obligated to raise that to the commission, and the commission's rules require require that type of exhaustion, or else the commission can deem that issue abandoned. But it gets worse than that, because at the commission stage, Chamberlain argued, for example, in its statement on public interest, which is Exhibit 3 to the commission's opposition here, and it's something that I think that the merits panel, the unredacted version of, it gets into gate operators and commercial operators, and then it says, and this part is redacted, and I don't think it really should be, because this has become public at least since then, that the recommended exclusion and cease and desist order, which at that point was what was recommended by the ALJ at a time when the notice of investigation read as it read, here affects, and they said, nearly all of Chamberlain Group's products. And then Chamberlain came in with its arguments and its declarations about gate operators and commercial operators.
What did the ID say about the recommended scope?
Well, the ID said that the parties dispute whether Chamberlain's gate operators are within the scope of this investigation. And then the ALJ rejected that argument after quoting Chamberlain's statement extensively. Now, the ALJ there doesn't get into commercial operators because Chamberlain didn't say a peep about commercial operators, in its argument concerning the scope of the investigation.
What I guess I'm asking you is, did the AJ say that the term garage door systems covered these other products?
I think that I would acknowledge he didn't expressly say so, but reading the ALJ's initial determination, you have to reach, I think that conclusion is implicit.
Why in the world?
Where he said it's within the scope of the investigation.
Why in the world didn't you just solve this problem by opening another 60-day review period when you modified the order?
I mean, we could do that. I mean, the commission's policy with respect to clarifications is that we typically don't do that. With the benefit of hindsight here, where maybe a lot of this could have been mooted. I mean, I think that's something that if this were ever to come up again, the commission would have to seriously consider.
This is Judge Chen. I have a question about Section 337K. And to me, to me, that statute and then the corresponding regulation, they seem to be going to a different kind of circumstance for when it would be appropriate to modify an order. And so its application in this particular instance doesn't make sense to me at all. Could you please explain what first your conception of what 337K covers, and then why what happened here could be deemed some kind of change in conditions that no longer, given that some condition no longer exists, it's okay to modify the exclusion order?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, the change in condition here is that throughout the commission investigation, Chamberlain acquiesced to the scope of the investigation, including the gate operators that the ALJ found. And then its submissions to the commissions repeatedly discussed that gate operators...
I mean, I would have thought the change in conditions would have been something like the accused products are no longer, you know, that the respondent has abandoned any interest in importing the accused products that have been found to infringe or something like that. Or maybe the patent has expired or the patent owner is no longer interested in pursuing the matter because they've settled the case with the respondent. And it's that kind of change in condition on the ground that warrants somehow modifying the exclusion order.
Well, I mean, those are certainly changes, but so is a situation in which a respondent says one thing to the commission, and then after the commission's order issues, collaterally attacks the scope of the commission's order based on what it says is the lack of clarity that is completely or at least substantially attributable to it and its conduct in the investigation. So I think that it's fair that that is within the scope of changed circumstances. And I think it's also within the scope of, you know, a tribunal's need to clarify its orders in the face of a party that blows hot and then cold on what the investigation covers. I mean, this gets into a lot of what's, I think, at issue in DeFerco, which Judge Dykem asked about, and I want to make sure that I don't miss that. I mean, this here is a formal adjudication. The orders here affect Chamberlain and no one else. The anti-dumping scheme, like rate making and like other types of orders and like rulemaking, affect the public at large. These orders only affect Chamberlain. The anti-dumping scheme, in part because of statutory requirements under 19 U.S.C. 1673E, maybe because of treaty obligations, have extensive scope discussion. I mean, the scope discussion in DeFerco was 45 columns of a Federal Register notice, so 15 full pages of a Federal Register notice.
So your theory is the ITC, because it's adjudicatory, doesn't have to write a clear order?
Well, I'm going to acknowledge this is a mess, but the issue is who is responsible for this mess?
Well,
Chamberlain is largely responsible for this mess.
Surely the ITC is in large part responsible for this because of the language that you use.
It was language that Chamberlain acquiesced to. I mean, we're not like, there are court decisions, including Smith-Klein, where tribunals aren't like pigs sniffing for truffles. And Chamberlain filed a 300-page post-hearing brief, a 100-page petition. Its petition didn't get into any of this. With the benefit of hindsight, does the commission in the future need to do better policing to avoid a circumstance in which a party collaterally attacks its order after having the opportunity to petition for review of something that the ALJ did, but the party didn't? Yeah, I think the commission's going to need to do a better job of it.
Counselor, this is Judge Reyna. Are the garage door openers and the commercial operators, are they the accused products in the Section 337 investigation?
They are. I mean, they're all listed in the complaint, and that's undisputed.
In addition to the complaint, the products that we're now talking about, these were actually investigated.
They were investigated. They were tried by consent. So there was discovery, and there were findings on these products. And then even at the public interest stage, there were arguments and declarations and statements about all of these products. One thing I would like to note is that Chamberlain has relied on due process principles that protect members of the public from certain agency decisions. But Chamberlain can't step into the shoes of a member of the public as though it had nothing to do with this.
You require that the order itself be distributed to all employees and other people involved. So you obviously think that the language of the order is going to be used by employees and others receiving a copy of it to interpret what it means.
Well, we also send, we also send customs, and we send USTR the ID, we send them the opinion. And you're right, was this as clear as it should be? And the answer is no, if Chamberlain's going to collaterally attack the scope of the order. But then the commission did what it should do, which is to step in and modify and clarify the order to make it conform to what was actually tried and what was understood by the commission and by the parties at the time of the underlying investigation.
Do you agree that if we conclude that this is a modification rather than a clarification, that there would have to be another 60-day review period by the president?
I believe that if the court were to find that the effect of this order was to materially widen the scope of the orders as originally issued, it should go through another presidential review period. That's the commission's policy. That's USTR's policy as set forth in SSIH. But what we believe is that Chamberlain is being disingenuous here about the scope of the investigation and the scope of the orders, and that under D.C. Circuit case law, for example, Gonzalez at 468 F3rd 826, a party is responsible for its self-inflicted harm, and that it even can lack standing to challenge what it complains of as agency conduct, where the party is party's harms are self-inflicted as here.
Could you move
Thank you.
To
Unless there any further questions.
I think why don't you talk about irreparable injury briefly. I mean, the cases that say that financial injury is not irreparable injury that you rely on are all situations where there is the likelihood of being able to collect the financial injury later on, either in a preliminary injunction context through the preliminary injunction bond, or in a situation where it's the patentee suing for infringement because it will get damages later on in the case. But are there any cases that say that financial injury is not irreparable injury where there is no possibility of recovering the financial injury later on in the proceeding?
Well, I think probably you would have to infer that every case in which this court has denied relief to a respondent by means of a stay pending appeal from a commission investigation would have to implicitly so find. I mean, the harm here that that Chamberlain complains of, they kept returning to the word cloud, which is about as opposite a word from the concrete specific harm as someone needs to show. And I think that if Chamberlain were correct, that any adjudicated infringer who suffers the taint of having been adjudged to be an infringer would satisfy Chamberlain's test. So I'm not aware of anything that would satisfy irreparable harm here. It is my understanding that Chamberlain began to stockpile these redesigned products ready to enter the United States, awaiting a customs decision. Mr. Bell, I think, is in a better position to discuss the actual business situation here. I would just like to say that in seeking the extraordinary relief, it's incumbent upon Chamberlain to put in declarations that explain what the nature is of its products coming into the United States, and it's not good enough to support a motion to stay where the theory of irreparable relief is inconsistent with their stay papers, as Judge Reyna found or noted, and it also seems to be something that's coming up for the first time by counsel at oral argument, apparently on the fly. So I hope that that helps. Do you have any follow-up questions, Judge Dyke?
I don't see any further questions here. Thank you, Mr. Rosenzweig. We'll hear from Mr.
Thank
Bell.
You.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Following up on the last point, I do think there's an independent basis in the lack of irreparable harm to deny this stay motion without getting into some of the interesting issues regarding the scope. And I think, following up on my colleague's point, their theory throughout their motion's papers about irreparable harm was that it would be catastrophic to their business. It would effectively foreclose them from all of these products, all of the accused products in the United States. They repeatedly made that point in their reply, as Judge Reyna noted, at pages 10 and 11. They confirmed that that was their theory of irreparable harm, and that if customs were to allow the redesigns, it would mitigate that harm, and we submit would eliminate it.
Did it make that argument before customs that it should find the redesign in order to facilitate this particular case or somehow?
I believe it did. As to this specific case, I think it made the argument that it was necessary to allow those for purposes of the business. I believe that was made. And so at least implicitly, it was kind of looking at this case. And in their reply, they also cited the Cisco order, which I think points the way for this court. In Cisco, this court held that as long as customs would allow the redesigned products, there wouldn't be irreparable harm, and therefore denied the stay on that basis. And went on to note, and this is important, I think, it went on to note that even if there was a subsequent proceeding about those redesigned products, that would be dealt with in due course. There could potentially be an enforcement action, there could potentially be a modification proceeding, and there would no doubt be an appeal from that, whoever was aggrieved. And this court could consider at that time whether the factors for a stay pending appeal of that new determination were met. Now is certainly not the time to take into account the possibility, the cloud, as my friend on the other side calls it, when there is no such catastrophic harm now in light of the redesigns. They've told their customers that
is
they
were... Is your position that the redesign is infringing?
I believe we're certainly evaluating customs' decision, and I think we will probably pursue some sort of proceeding to get that adjudicated.
How much time do you have to respond to that letter?
I think it depends on, I don't know the answer for sure, Your Honor, but my understanding is that under any of the procedures that we would pursue, it would be at least 6, 7, 9, 12 months before there would be any determination that could potentially stop those. And then, of course, as I noted, in an appeal of that proceeding, I'm sure whoever is aggrieved would argue that it should be stayed pending appeal, and the court could consider whether the irreparable harm occurs at that time, but there's certainly no irreparable harm now.
And so in the interim period, while this is being litigated, the redesigned products will continue to be admitted to the United States?
That is correct. That is correct. And Chamberlain has noted in letters to its customers the same day as customs, we submitted this as the second exhibit to our 28J letter, that the redesigns will ship immediately. And it also has noted to its customers in other exhibits that it had stockpiled the redesigns in anticipation of customs allowing it. So here's what Chamberlain said at one point in Exhibit 21 to our opposition. Updates will not affect the overall functionality or reliability of our products and will not impact our ability to supply product in any way. So I think that's a pretty clear admission that there's no irreparable harm here, and they're having to, as Mr. Rosenzweig said, cobble it together on the fly here at argument. I would note that in their 28J response, they didn't include any of that and in fact, didn't mention irreparable harm, which I found notable. They didn't contest a 28J assertion that there is now no irreparable harm, and I think there is no irreparable harm.
Getting to the harm, the likelihood of success, we're here trying to figure out what does garage door systems mean, as that term is used in the remedial order. And that is that a term of art? Garage door systems? Do people in this field think of the term garage door systems as necessarily encompassing gate operators and commercial operators?
I don't know for sure. I think it's certainly been used colloquially in this proceeding.
I mean, certainly in this proceeding, the term was introduced by your side in the complaint.
Correct.
The complaint says garage door systems. And
correct.
Then the commission picked up on that in its notice of investigation.
That's right. And in our...
It quoted garage door systems, and then it carried through on the remedial order. And I'm just wondering, why did your side pick garage door systems when it sounds a lot like garage door openers?
Yeah.
If you really intended that term to encompass things as disparate as gate operators and commercial operators.
I think with the benefit of hindsight, and now the ambiguity that Chamberlain has introduced, perhaps we would write it differently. But I would note that in the complaint, we clearly intended it to include gates and commercial operators, which As an aside, I don't see much reasonable argument that commercial garage doors aren't garage doors.
But did the complaint use the term garage door systems to include gate operators and commercial operators?
Yes.
Yes. What did it say?
At paragraph 4.31, we included a chart that listed all of the accused model numbers, which goes well beyond what we needed to do. So to the extent there was any ambiguity...
Okay, no, but that's a different question. My question was the term, the specific terminology, garage door systems. Is there any statement in the record here that that includes gate operators and commercial operators?
In the record, absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, weird.
So I would point to two things. One, there were a series of joint stipulations by the parties. Now, does it come right out and say the term garage door systems includes gate operators? No, but what it does do is a joint stipulation that the accused products in this investigation include gate operators and commercial operators. That's at Exhibit 5 of our
position. That's a different question. That's not using the terminology garage door systems to refer to these other products.
So fast forwarding then, and I would note that Chamberlain throughout the litigation acceded to that scope, and then they actually first teed up this issue. In other words, the meaning of garage door systems. And to answer your question, Judge Dyke, I would say this is a usage in the industry where Chamberlain teed that up and finally contested it on the eve of the hearing. So we're looking at March of 2021, late March of 2021. They first teed it up in their pre-hearing brief, kind of as a throwaway, and they also teed it up in a motion in limine shortly thereafter. That was twice rejected. The ALJ rejected that specific meaning of that term and said, no, it doesn't exclude those other things. And in the ID, it rejected it again at pages 13 and 14, excuse me. Those were not petitioned. And under standard agency procedures, think if you analogize it to claim construction, for example. This court has repeatedly held that if a party gets an adverse claim construction from an ID and doesn't petition to the ITC, that is waived forever. That is the meaning of that term for that proceeding. That was in the Finnegan case. That was in the Allied case that my friends on the other side cited. So,
in other words, Chamberlain wanted the ALJ to believe that garage door systems meant only garage door openers, and the ALJ disagreed with that, and then they didn't petition that
correct
dispute to the commission.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right.
Absolutely right in the sense that the AJ said that the proceeding covered gate operators and commercial operators, or correct in the sense that the ALJ said this terminology, garage door systems, includes these other two items.
It did not expressly have a separate section and say, I'm hereby construing this and it means this. But what it did do, and I think you look at how Chamberlain teed up the issue. Chamberlain teed up the issue exactly as Your Honor phrased it, that the term garage door systems does not include gate openers and commercial. So that was how it was teed up in the mill, and that's how it was teed up for the ID. And that's what was rejected. So whether the AJ could have gone on and said, and specifically garage door systems includes these things, I don't think it had to because it adjudicated those very products throughout the entire investigation. It was conceded that a certain garage door product, the C205, for purposes of the 935 patent, was representative of all accused products. That's another joint stipulation that's at Exhibit 6 of our opposition. And these are Chamberlain's own words. The parties agree that, C205, which is a garage residential garage door product, is representative of all accused products. And they concurrently joint stipulated that the accused products include commercial and gate operators. In the context of this litigation, it's hard to see how they can claim any sort of surprise. And when they finally did challenge that scope, they were rejected. They didn't petition.
Do we still have Mr. Rosenzweig on the phone?
Yes, I'm sorry. I pressed some button accidentally up here, and I apologize for the interruption.
So to use Judge Chen's term, it was painfully obvious to everyone throughout, including the commission and all the parties, what the commission believed the scope was. And ultimately, if there were any ambiguity, that's precisely what the regulation rule 210.14C is designed to allow. What it says is if there are issues that are not expressly in the notice of investigation, but are fairly included in it and were tried by implied consent, the ITC can, and this is a quote, shall be allowed at any time to go back and amend that notice. So to the extent there were any ambiguity or concerns, the ITC has properly exercised its authority to clarify that under its own regulations. And we think that was proper. And I don't think there's any cause for a stay pending appeal. These are types of issues, perhaps interesting, that can be decided in the normal course of this appeal. And especially in view of the complete lack of irreparable harm, by we contend Chamberlain's own admission, we think that the motion for a stay pending appeal should be denied.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bell.
Thank you.
Mrs. Degen, you have 2 minutes.
May it please the court. If I could, I'd like to talk a little bit about what we heard from both counsel, which is a lot of regulatory history and not a lot of examination of the actual language of the orders and the notice of investigation, which is, as this court has said, exactly backwards. If we do look at the regulatory history here, which I will focus on because they did, we see that the ITC intentionally chose a narrower phrase, garage door systems, rather than movable barrier operators, which is in the title and elsewhere in the notice of investigation.
Why didn't you make these objections, raise this fight during the investigation itself?
So, Your Honor,
I understand that the products we're talking about were the accused products in the 337 investigation, correct?
So the accused products are defined...
Were the accused products part of the 337? Are the products we're talking about the accused products in the 337 investigation?
The answer is yes and no. So the answer is yes insofar as there was discovery, there were findings, all that is true, but the notice of investigation defines the accused products as garage door systems, which is not in, it's not the broader term, mobile barrier operators.
Was data submitted with respect to the accused products?
It was. Chamberlain complied with discovery, which is broader.
I'm just asking a simple question here. Were the products that we're talking about the accused products that were the subject of the 337 investigation?
I will say they are not the accused products as defined in the notice of investigation, but discovery was had and there were findings of infringement with respect to one of the patents.
On the basis of that, why didn't you make the arguments you're making now? Why didn't you make them then?
Couple of comments on that, Your Honor. First of all, we did not lay behind the log on this. This was raised. But second, it is not Chamberlain's position to move to amend the notice of investigation.
Where was it raised?
It was raised, as counsel mentioned, in the pre-hearing brief.
Show me on the record.
It was in, if we go to, I have a site here, Your Honor, let me find it. In the modification opinion itself, let me pull the site. List the places where it was raised.
You had a motion in limine. You had a post-hearing brief in front of the ALJ.
Yes, I was just getting the site. I can tell you what they are, but citation I'd have to pull. But yes, it was in the pre-hearing briefing, the motion in limine. It was in the reply brief to the petition. It was... I believe also in
okay, so you're saying that at those points
post-hearing brief.
You made the argument that gate operators or commercial operators was not part of the investigation.
Yes, and some of them just said gates operators, some of them said both. It was mentioned, so we didn't lay behind the law.
I just didn't see that. I just didn't see that you made these arguments at that point.
We raised it. That's we certainly did. The motion limine is a good example.
That gate operators and commercial operators were excluded from the scope of the investigation, should not be investigated.
We said that there should not be evidence in the motion limine relating to, I believe, gate operators. Yes.
If you believe that gate operators and commercial operators were outside the scope of the investigation and the ALJ was wrong to conclude otherwise, why didn't you... preserve that argument and make it in your petition to the commission?
Okay, so let me understand your question. Let me answer it. So first, with the motion limine, there's no obligation. That dealt with the hearing. So there was no obligation to do an interlocutory petition on that. And once the hearing was over, it made little sense to go ahead and argue about
the motion. But after you received the initial decision from the ALJ finding all of your accused products to be infringing all of these patent claims, that was the time when, on petition to the commission, you could have said, we have persisted in this argument throughout the course of the investigation from the ALJ that these particular products, the gate operators and commercial operators, are not properly part of this investigation. The ALJ disagreed with us. Please correct the ALJ on that. You didn't have that in the petition, and I'm wondering why.
So it's true it's not in the petition. The petition, word limited, focused on the things that were common, the arguments that were common to the products. But I will say there was no obligation for us to do that. So I appreciate it could have been done, just as it could have been done, but there was no obligation to do it because the notice of investigation cannot be changed by fiat or interpretation by the ALJ. It was outside his power, so it was dicta. It couldn't be done. It needed a motion, or the ITC had to do it sua sponte, neither of which happened. OHD never made that motion. What it did instead before the commission, it offered a proposed LEO, this is on page appendix 34, paragraph 2, that actually used mobile barrier operators as covered articles. Instead of making the motion it should have, it tried to use its LEO, proposed LEO, and the commission then rejected that. So from our perspective, when we got the order, we had won that issue. The commission was well aware of the proper scope of the investigation. It saw OHD trying to circumvent the requirement to make a motion and said, no, you can't have that. The scope is defined to the notice of investigations. Our orders are going to be commensurate with the scope of the notice of investigation. It didn't say any of this, but its orders told us and the public that it was garage door systems and that we didn't have to do anything to change it.
Did you make this argument in relation to the initial determination?
So, as I think I was telling Judge Chen, we did not put it in the petition. It was not in the petition. So that's clear.
I'm interested in a good, clear response to Judge Chen's question. Whether you raised these arguments, in other words, did you not forfeit these arguments by failure to raise them with respect to the initial determination?
We did not forfeit them, but we did, in fact, not put it in the petition to the commission after the final initial determination. They were not forfeited. It was an issue that was, again, at least mentioned in reply. But again, we're saying it wasn't done. There's no question. We didn't put it in the petition. But we did not have to. And the issue was squarely before the commission insofar as it issued an order after OHD had proposed a broader order using mobile barrier operators.
Under the commission's rules, aren't you required to state any objections or problems that you have with respect to the initial determination?
We are. The rules talk about you have to include issues in the petition.
And if you don't, I mean, I think the case law is plenary that if you do not object or file a response to the initial determination, you have forfeited that. That's clear exhaustion of administrative remedy law.
That is certainly the rules, but I would say this was utter dicta. The ALJ was not authorized to do this. He did not make it, as Judge Dykin mentioned, didn't make a true interpretation, and there was no forfeiture or waiver by not putting in the petition, and there's no acquiescence. If you look at the history.
So was the briefing before the commission as to the scope of the exclusion order?
I think, but prior to the modification.
You said a moment ago that Overhead proposed the scope of the order, which would cover use a broader term, movable barriers. When did that happen?
That is part of the briefing before the commission, Your Honor. I can pull. I don't have the date on it, but it was as part of the normal practice. Is both sides put in proposed orders should the commission choose to issue orders.
And your proposed order was limited to garage door systems.
That is my recollection. Although I can't. I don't. That's not in the record. I don't have a cite for you. We. I think to the extent we did that,
there was
my
a difference
colleague
in the scope of the order as proposed by Overhead and by Chamberlain.
If you look at ADD 34 of our brief, you'll see the scope of overhead doors, paragraph 2, and that talks about defining covered articles as movable barrier-operated systems. I don't have in front of me, and I apologize, I can certainly bring it, get submitted after the argument. I don't have the exact language that Chamberlain may have proposed. I just don't recall, and I apologize. I believe they did put in a proposed order, but I'll tell you right now, I am not certain, and I don't remember the exact language.
Okay. Those are the further questions. Thank you, Ms. Degnan. Thank all counsel. The case is submitted. That concludes our session this morning.